Hi, I'm Mike Seidman.
And I'm Mark Tushnet.
And you are listening to our podcast, Supreme Betrayal, How the Supreme Court and Constitutional Law Have Failed America. Here we go with another of our current events episodes. Again, we're going to be trying to connect events that are going on now to the kinds of issues of constitutional theory that our podcast is focused on. Today, we're going to talk about arrests of public officials for interfering with immigration enforcement. We're going to talk about the events in Los Angeles and say something about the Trump administration's attempt to stop Harvard from enrolling international students. Next time, we'll talk about some of the cases the court decided this term, including probably most prominently the Birthright Citizenship Universal Injunction case. This episode begins, though, by taking us back to the run-up to the Civil War. And by the way, I guess at some point, we probably ought to say something about why the Civil War seems to play such a large role in our efforts to work out basic ideas about U.S. constitutionalism.
Okay, so it's May 24, 1854 in Boston, Massachusetts. 2 days earlier, Congress had passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which effectively undid the compromise in 1820 that limited the scope of slavery's expansion into the western part of the continent. On the evening of the 24th, Asa Butman, a U.S. Marshal, confronted Anthony Burns on Boston Street. Butman had a warrant for Burns' arrest as a fugitive slave issued under the notorious Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, enacted as part of the so-called Compromise of 1850.
Apart from the injustice of the very practice of returning enslaved people who had escaped, the 1850 Act was widely reviled in the North because of a specific provision. And under the Act, a federal magistrate, basically a judge, would decide whether a person brought before him as a fugitive was actually a fugitive. If the judge said no, the person was released and the judge went home with a fee of $5. If the judge said yes, the person was returned to slavery in the South, or rendered in the terms that was used then, and the judge went home with $10 in his pocket. By the way, that's about $100 in today's money.
You probably don't remember this, Mike, but the year we clerked at the court decided a case that presented a problem descended from that obviously outrageous disparity. The details of the 1972 case don't matter, but it relied on a 1927 decision where the Supreme Court said it certainly deprives a defendant of due process of law to subject his liberty to the judgment of a court, the judge of which has a direct, personal, substantial, pecuniary interest in reaching a conclusion against him in his case. And that describes this provision of the Fugitive Slave Act.
Back to Boston in 1854, after Butman stopped Burns, a bunch of Butman's allies moved out of the shadows of nearby buildings, grabbed Burns, and delivered him to the federal courthouse across the street. Word of Burns' detention spread over the next few days. A couple of prominent anti-slavery lawyers provided Burns with representation at the hearing about whether he was indeed a fugitive.
But, and here's where the story gets interesting for our purposes, anti-slavery activists were organizing outside the courthouse. Eventually, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a young Unitarian minister supported by a handful of others, including leaders of Boston's Black community, grabbed a wooden beam and broke into the courthouse intending to free Burns. Their attack failed and one police officer was killed in the skirmish. The abolitionists then raised enough money to purchase Burns from his enslaver, who was happy enough to accept the money and get out of town. But Boston's district attorney stepped in and blocked the sale, apparently because he felt some duty to vindicate the officer who had been killed. At the hearing a couple of days later, Burns' lawyers raised a host of legal and factual challenges to Burns's rendition, but the federal magistrate rejected them all and found that Burns was a fugitive and handed him over to his enslaver. A force of more than 1,500 soldiers and city militia members was deployed to ensure that Burns and enslaver could get safely through the crowd of thousands on the streets to the ship that would take them back to Virginia.
Just a terrible set of events. But you might ask, what does that all that have to do with current events? Well, of course, we've seen episodes of law enforcement officials grabbing people off the street and futile efforts to block the rendition of non-citizens when they're being sent to conditions not altogether unlike enslavement. And we've seen the deployment of soldiers to aid in the rendition. So the events we've described do have some disturbing modern parallels. Still, the laws involved today are quite different. So why, Mark, do you think that the story of Anthony Burns tells us something about the U.S. Constitution in our old?
Well, you might disagree with the precise formulation I'm about to offer, and I'm willing to tweak it, but the core of the point is this. I think that what Higginson did, violent resistance to a law he correctly regarded as outrageously unjust, is a mode of constitutional action open to all of us. Not so incidentally, Higginson raised money to fund John Brown's attack on the armory at Harper's Ferry, and maybe incidentally, he was also a close friend and supporter of Emily Dickinson. If you want, we can explore later some of the qualifications built into this, that the law was outrageously unjust, not merely unjust, that today almost all would agree that the law was unjust, though at the time lots of people thought it was perfectly fine. For the moment, though, I hope you'll let me draw out the current events implications.
Well, I'm happy to let you do that and eager to hear what you have to say. I really don't want to get you off track, but I do want to add a couple of things at this point. First, in addition to the egregiousness of the injustice, before people undertake actions like this, I think they ought to think about whether what they're doing is likely to make the situation better or worse. That's a prudential rather than a moral judgment, or maybe the more accurate way to put it is that making the moral judgment should include a prudential component. And then the second thing is that many people would distinguish between violent and nonviolent resistance. As we've discussed earlier, personally, I'm not a complete pacifist. I do think that sometimes a violent resistance is an appropriate response. I'm thinking, for example, of armed Jewish resistance to the Nazis in the Warsaw Ghetto. I think that was pretty clearly the right thing to do, even though it was largely ineffectual. But in part for prudential reasons and in part for moral reasons, I think the bar is much higher if one is going to resort to violence.
Well, mostly I agree, but here are some qualifications or additions. First, almost all the time, there's no central committee directing this sort of process. And it's almost inevitable that some people will end up thinking prudentially that nonviolent protest isn't going to get the job done. And participants in protests sometimes get an adrenaline rush as the events unfold and do things that they hadn't planned to. And I think there are different kinds of action that get described as violence. There's throwing rocks or water balloons. They're spitting at police officers, which is technically assault, but it's not like bashing them with a pole, as happened on January 6th. There's pushing back when officers push you. And of course, there's violence coming from the so-called forces of order. Not only the violent actions that precipitate responses from the targets, but violence they initiate against protesters. And there's something our colleague Mike Klarman emphasizes to my mind a bit too much, but that's irrelevant here. Sometimes the people planning protests instruct their colleagues to remain nonviolent, and they do, but the planners know that the police will probably respond to nonviolent protests with a violent response, and sometimes actually hope that they will. And finally, the history of moral progress in the U.S. involves substantial episodes of recurrent physical violence before the Civil War, John Brown again, but also violent resistance by the enslaved to their enslavers, labor organizing, the Battle of the Overpass at Ford Motor Company, sit-down strikes, the Stonewall Riots, and as we've mentioned, the modern civil rights movement. It's not clear to me that what implications these things have for ongoing protests or future ones, but they should be the part of the repertoire of our thinking. So what made me think about Anthony Burns? The arrest of Milwaukee Judge Hannah Dugan for interfering with the performance of official duties by ICE agents and the indictment of Representative LaMonica McIver for assaulting ICE and other federal agents.
Another quick aside here with an apology for, again, getting you off track. The Dugan and McIver cases seem to be part of a growing and disturbing pattern of official violence directed at opposition figures. We also have the arrest of a leading labor figure in Los Angeles, the arrest of Newark's mayor in the same episode that led to the charges against Representative McIver, the raid by Homeland Security officers on Representative Jerry Nadler's congressional office and the handcuffing of his aide, and the manhandling of Senator Alex Padilla during a news conference conducted by the Secretary of Homeland Security. These attacks are virtually unprecedented in American history. The closest analogy, and it's not fully analogous because it wasn't being done by official members of the executive branch, was the assault on Charles Sumner by a member of Congress on the floor of the Senate. So these are yet another line crossed in the march toward an American dictatorship.
All of which makes the upcoming trials of Dugan and McIver even more important. These are cases that are going to be heard in court, and lawyers for the defendants are going to make a bunch of legal arguments, just as Burns's lawyers did. I want to focus on something else, the facts of the cases, not in the sense that I want to analyze what actually happened, but in the sense that if the cases move forward, someone's going to have to decide whether the facts as established in court show that the defendants violated the law. And again, shortcutting an intermediate stage, that's going to be a jury. But in addition to determining the facts, jurors will need to make another decision. They could properly decide that even if the facts showed that the defendants violated the applicable statutes, they should not be found guilty. In doing so, in my view, the jury would be acting extra legally in the service of the constitutional system overall. My guess is that you won't like that last phrase and prefer something like acting extra legally in the service of simple justice. What I want to explore is the idea of jury nullification as a form of enforcing the Constitution. That's the connection to Higginson's actions. As our colleague Larry Kramer put it, Higginson was acting in line with a long tradition of what Kramer, using the language of the early 1800s, calls the people out of doors, the people acting on the streets in demonstrations centered explicitly around their claims about the Constitution's meaning.
I'm afraid still another aside. The nullification issue arises only if, on the facts, Judge Dugan and Representative McIver indeed engaged in conduct that violated the law. And speaking for myself, I'm not at all sure that they did. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that they're factually guilty. There's actually a bit of law about jury nullification. Everybody agrees that juries have the raw power to acquit in the face of facts and evidence going the other way. But the law is more complicated and paradoxical than this, than a simple statement like that would suggest. And so we need to talk about the complications and the paradox, but I'm going to postpone that discussion to let you tell another story first. But before I let you do that, let me make what I think is an obvious point. Nullification can sometimes be a good thing, and it can sometimes be a bad thing. The problem is that we're certain to disagree about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing in a particular case. And because nullification occurs outside standard legal structures, there's really no external referee who decides whether it's a good or a bad thing. So here's a case where nullification is pretty clearly bad. Acquittals of members of the Ku Klux Klan for murdering or assaulting blacks in the 1960s South, and more recent acquittals of some police officers who were charged with murdering or assaulting black people they arrested. But there are also less obvious cases. So, for example, my colleague Paul Butler stirred up a hornet's nest when he urged D.C. juries to acquit black defendants who were obviously guilty of the crime of drug possession. Reasonable people thought that Butler was right and that jury nullification was absolutely the right thing to do. But reasonable people also thought that Butler was wrong and that jury nullification in that situation was a terrible thing to do. And a final point before you get to your story, jury nullification can cut both ways. So juries might acquit people who are factually guilty, but so long as the prosecution makes out a prima facie case, they can also convict people who are factually innocent. And it's not clear, at least to me, whether that second form of jury nullification is ever a good thing.
That's obviously right. And in talking about jury nullification, I'm not committed to the view, and nobody could sensibly be committed to the view, that jury nullification was an unequivocally good phenomenon. It's just something that's available in the repertoire of, again, in my view, constitutional, in the service of forcing constitutionalism. It doesn't mean it's always used in that service. It could be used for other things as well, and that might be bad. But it is part of the repertoires. And here's a case, this is the other story of what seems to me to be pretty clearly a good thing jury nullification. It comes from a PBS special called Inside the Jury, which you can watch on YouTube. The producers remarkably got everyone's permission to film the actual deliberations of a Milwaukee jury. The case involved a defendant who had previously been convicted of a felony. He was trying to turn his life around and decided that he should become a private investigator. It's pretty clear that his cognitive capacities were limited. He took a correspondence course about becoming a private investigator, and at one point the course material said you should buy a handgun. So he did. Then, unrelated to the purchase, he went to a local police station where an officer thought he recognized him as a person who had been convicted. The officer asked him for some identification, and the defendant handed over the sales receipt for the gun. The officer told the defendant to go home and bring the gun to the station, which he did, whereupon he was arrested for being a felon in possession of a gun. Now, I'm going to skip an important part of the story here, which we'll come back to, and go directly to the jury room. Inside the room, it was pretty clear from the outset that quite a few jurors thought that the prosecution was a ridiculous overreach, but that almost all of them agreed that the prosecution had indeed proved the elements of the crime as the judge described them. The defendant had been convicted of a felony, and he knowingly possessed a gun. Then one jury member, a professor of English, came up with an ingenious out. Sure, the defendant knew that he possessed the gun, but did he know that possessing the gun was illegal? As a matter of law, that question was irrelevant, but it was enough for the jurors who pretty quickly came to a not guilty verdict. And here's the part I left out. The judge allowed the defendant's lawyer, a public defender, expressly to argue to the jury they had the power to acquit in the face of the law and the facts. He argued, that is, that the jury had a power to nullify.
So that's a really remarkable story, Mark. As you're reciting it, I couldn't help wonder whether one of the things going on here was what social scientists call the Hawthorne effect, or if you're interested in the bizarre behavior of subatomic particles, it's analogous to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. That is to say, whether the very act of observing this didn't have something to do with what was observed. So I just wonder, with that, and it's just speculation, whether the fact that everybody knew this was being publicly recorded had some effect on what actually happened.
Before you go on, I just want to note, I think that might well be right, but that's sort of also true about the Dugin and McIver cases. That is, everybody's going to be watching them. Everybody knows that they're going to be watched.
That's true, but they won't see the actual jury deliberation. But yes, to some extent, all of this does relate to the public aspects of trials and their results. Here's maybe a more important point. I don't want our listeners to think that what the judge did in this case is at all typical. In fact, the law almost everywhere is the other way. The law about jury nullification is really paradoxical. Juries have the right to nullify, but judges are not supposed to tell them that they have the right, and they're not supposed to let defense counsel inform the jury that they have the right. And in fact, almost everywhere, judges tell juries the opposite. They say, you've got an obligation to follow the law whether or not you think it's just. And jurors who say that they might not do that, they're routinely challenged for cause and not permitted to serve. When I'm called for jury service in D.C., because I'm a lawyer, judges ask a standard, really strangely worded question. They ask, when deciding this case, will you follow my instructions or the law as you know it to be? And I have a standard answer. I say, well, Your Honor, that just depends on how bad the mistake you make is. And usually, if not quite always, that leads to my being dismissed from the jury.
Oh, just one really tiny point, and we disagree about this. Of course, you're right that the practice is that judges do exactly what you say and don't allow lawyers to make nullification arguments, and they certainly don't instruct jurors that they have the power to nullify. As a matter of practice, that's clearly right. Our tiny disagreement is that I think that's just you're describing practice. You think you're describing what the law requires. I think that the law actually gives judges discretion to allow the lawyer to make those arguments, as in the Milwaukee case that I described, but that they almost always exercise that discretion against allowing it.
Well,
but as I say, that's a minor point.
So it's a little hard to talk about what the law is, given the fact that you have at least 50 different jurisdictions, and I'm sure you can find jurisdictions doing all kinds of things. But taking as a given what is at least the standard practice, and I think the law in the vast majority of places, we're stuck with a kind of contradiction. So in one famous Court of Appeals case, the court tried to resolve the contradiction by arguing that we could get just the optimal level of jury nullification by permitting it on the one hand, but on the other, not letting counsel argue to the jury that they could nullify and having the trial judge tell the jury that they're not allowed to nullify. And the standard analogy here is to speed limits. So we set the speed limit at, say, 60 miles per hour, but the real speed limit is between 65 and 70. Why don't we tell people that that's the real speed limit? Because if we do, they'll go 75 or 80. So by lying to them, we get the optimal outcome. Now, I don't think that strategy actually works very well, either in jury nullification cases or with regard to speed limits. But before I say why, I want to suggest that this is part of a much broader problem. These are examples of a conflict between law and what might be called non-law. So law is a closed system with its own rules, conventions, types of arguments, its own ideology. It presents itself as objective, neutral, rule-bound, but it always stands vulnerable to a way of thinking that's outside of that system, non-law. Non-law is anarchic, particularistic, subjective. If one likes Freudian terms, one might think of law as our superego and non-law as our id. So our official position is, or our legal position, unsurprisingly, is that everybody ought to obey the law. But that official position can't quite snuff out the threat posed by non-law. There are circumstances where clearly the right thing to do is to violate the law. So what Higginson did is almost certainly one of those circumstances. What the jury did in the case you describe also seems like a justified triumph of non-law over law. Perhaps an acquittal for Judge Dugan and Representative McIver might be also a justified triumph for non-law. But here's the problem. Law can't acknowledge limits posed by the system of thought that is its rival. So the law can't both say, this is the law, and you have to obey it, and then say, but actually, sometimes the right thing to do is to disobey it. So the law is always trying to imperialistically capture non-law, to co-opt non-law and include non-law within its domain. So you might think, for example, of courts of equity, which arose in England to soften the rigidity of common law courts. But really, all that does is to redefine the law. It doesn't make the problem go away. It's still no answer to the subversive challenge from outside of law. The challenger can still say, well, we should not follow the law, even as it's been redefined. So the speed limit and jury nullification examples show how we try to wiggle out of that dilemma. And it turns out they're not the only examples. Another example comes from what some people, including Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, have said about what's sometimes called states of exception. So in the American constitutional tradition, that problem typically arises in cases where the president asserts inherent emergency powers. In two great cases, one involving the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and the other involving President Truman's seizure of steel mills to prevent a strike during the Korean War. In those two cases, Justice Jackson argued, in effect, that emergency powers were like the speed limit. So the right thing for the president to do is to exercise them when there really is an emergency. But the right thing for courts to do is to tell the president that he's acted illegally. That's the right thing for courts to do because if they don't, presidents are going to use the power when there's not really an emergency. In effect, they're going to go 70 miles per hour when we want them to go only 65. So why doesn't that work? Once again, I think the problem is that law can't acknowledge the legitimacy of non-law. That's why the law has to keep secret the resort to non-law. So as soon as Justice Jackson publicly stated his position, he kind of gives the game away by candidly saying what he's really doing. He makes it the law. And similarly, when drivers catch on to the fact that they're not going to be pulled over if they go 65 miles an hour, that in effect becomes the law, and so they're going to drive 70 miles an hour. So the same problem comes up with regard to jury nullification. Judges tell jurors that they shouldn't do this, but it's really hard to keep the secret from coming out. So, for example, some right-wingers took up the banner of jury nullification in what they called the informed jury movement. One of their strategies was to place one-page sheets describing jury nullification on the windshields of cars parked near courthouses, on the theory that some of those cars were probably being driven by potential jurors. Now, unsurprisingly, prosecutors didn't like that. And they tried to use various local ordinances about things like littering and control of space near public buildings to stop the practice. But some courts said no, the leaflets were protected by the First Amendment.
So again, I mostly agree with what you said, but I have a couple of, cavils maybe. The words in effect are doing quite a bit of work in what you said. There's a non-trivial literature in jurisprudence about whether there's a difference between something that is the law and something that's in effect the law, but frankly, I've never really understood it well, and certainly don't think we have to explore it here. It also occurred to me, I like your Freudian analogy, but in some sense, there is a third term, which for my mind is the key in what Freud says. So you said the law is our superego and non-law is our id. What Freud said, I think it's in some sense his most heroic statement, where id was ego shall be, not superego, ego. And you know, if I wanted to pursue the metaphor, I'd say there's an intermediate space between the non-law of the id and the law of the superego that's occupied by the analogy to Freud's ego. But again, go ahead.
One of the recurring, how shall I put it, searches, both in Freudian psychology and in law, is the search for some position, some intermediate position outside the conflict where you can just see things clearly. And the question is whether there is such a position. But that would get us really even more far afield than we are now. So right. Maybe we better cut off this analogy while we have the chance.
Okay, so the payoff. I'll use Judge Dugan's case as the vehicle and leave the New Jersey congressperson's case for listeners to fill in. Here's my overstated version of what she and her lawyer should do. Announce at the earliest possible moment that they're ready for trial, cross-examine the government's witnesses, put on no witnesses of their own, not even the judge herself, and then argue to the jury that it's ridiculous to treat what she did as a criminal offense. In effect, though not in words, to argue for jury nullification. This is overstated because her lawyers will have a better sense of what's tactically sensible than I do, and they might well make different choices. Now, 2 points. She's going to have a jury from the Eastern District of Milwaukee, Eastern District of Wisconsin, which includes Milwaukee, but also some more conservative areas. So she's probably going to have a bunch of jurors who, like those in the gun possession case, will be looking for some way to come out on her side. And as you suggested earlier, her lawyers are probably going to be able to point to ambiguities in the prosecution's evidence, probably going to her knowledge that what she was doing might lead people to think that she was helping someone avoid arrest by ICE agents, to give those juries the hook they'll want so that they can say to themselves, we didn't really nullify.
So I agree with most of what you've said here. Whether this works or not, though, I think depends a lot on whether the trial judge is sympathetic. An unsympathetic trial judge will try to shut down even a subtle hint to the jury that it should nullify. Of course, if that happens, the defendant's lawyers might try to, in effect, turn the jury against the trial judge. Here, though, I can report from my own sad experience as a trial lawyer, that's usually really, really hard to do. And I don't think I ever successfully did it. To use President Trump's unfortunate expression, the defense attorney just doesn't hold the cards when he goes up against the trial judge.
Now, again, a note, Trump used that phrase in many contexts, but one was the context of the Kilmora Abrego Garcia case. And it turns out that he held more cards than Trump thought he did.
Well, we will see about that. Well, the case is not over
no,
yet.
No, I want to make it clear. Secretary Noem said Garcia was never going to be on U.S. soil again. She said that expressly.
And so now he's on U.S. soil until in terrible conditions until they deport him again.
To Venezuela. I understand that. But they said he would never touch U.S. soil again. And he did, because he had more cards than they thought he had. More seriously, but it's an example. The Garcia case is an example. In political cases, the deck is different from the one used in the more routine cases that were part of your practice experience. Now it's stacked differently. Mostly, it's stacked in political cases against defendants. I agree, but there are some cards in the political case deck that defendants can sometimes successfully deploy.
Or maybe the judge will just have a better lawyer than I was. It's entirely possible. Another point: I think there's an analogy here to the subtle distinction we talked about in an earlier episode between constitutional violation and what you and your seminal work have called constitutional workarounds. So faced with a constitutional rule that makes no sense, one response is just to ignore it or disobey it, but another is to find a clever lawyer with a clever argument that doesn't directly disavow the rule, but somehow makes it inapplicable. And similarly, sometimes good defense lawyers don't explicitly argue for nullification, but suggest a version of the facts that probably would not be accepted by the jury but for their discomfort with convicting the defendant. And that might well be what the lawyer did in Inside the Jury. It might also be the tactic that lawyers for Judge Dugan and Representative McIver use. Suppose instead the jury engages in outright nullification. Is that a form of constitutional action? Well, we seem to be back to definitional questions, and I think both of us have already experienced quite a bit of frustration talking about what counts as constitutional and what doesn't. I don't think much really turns on the answer, but to the extent it matters as a rhetorical matter, I'm inclined to resist your characterization as you predicted I would be. We run into the same problem we ran into earlier. You can avoid criticisms of constitutionalism by expanding its definition in a way that co-opts critics, sort of like the way the law tries to expand its domain to co-opt non-law. But the price you pay for that is sacrificing what is distinctive and worth talking about concerning constitutionalism. So just speaking for me, I would rather keep the hard edges of the definition of constitutionalism so that there's something there worthy of criticism. So just for the sake of analytic clarity, I would reserve the word constitutional for a rule that is legally entrenched more than other rules. But if you want to define constitutional differently, I don't think anything substantive turns on it. We've been through all that before, and I'm not sure there's much left that's useful to say about it.
Okay, well, fine. Let's turn to other current events. The second topic we wanted to discuss involved what's playing out in Los Angeles and other cities, but there may not be much to say about that either. I'd actually thought that we would want at this point also to talk about whether President Trump acted within his constitutional authority in doing, however you want to characterize it, doing what he did with respect to Iran. But it turns out, you know, that's over and done with and probably not worth exploring now.
Maybe it's over and done with. Maybe so. We'll have to see.
Yeah. Although I do want to note, just in this connection on the definitional point, lots of people, not just me, but lots of people want it. I think it's not clear that it's profitable, but they do seem to want to talk about the question, is it constitutionally permissible for Trump to do what might be getting us involved in a war when the Constitution says Congress has the power to declare war. I don't think it's profitable to explore that question. I just want to note that as a matter of linguistic practice, lots of folks use constitutional in that context. So the Los Angeles stuff overlaps with some things we've already discussed, in particular presidential emergency power and civil disobedience.
I worry, and I think I'm not alone in worrying, that we're approaching our what might be called a Reichstag fire moment. So after Hitler became chancellor, he manufactured a crisis about the burning down of the parliament building to seize emergency power that he never relinquished. I worry that Trump will do the same thing. The sad fact is that we have 3.5 years of his administration left to get through. What do you think the chances are that we're going to survive that period of time without Trump declaring martial law? And I'm afraid I would say it's close to zero.
Just a note here, full-scale declarations of martial law have been rare in U.S. history. I think, though I could be wrong, that the last time it happened was in Hawaii during World War II. And that example illustrates another point. Technically, martial law means only in scare quotes here, that the making, application, and enforcement of ordinary law shifts from civil authorities to military commanders. Whether that's bad depends on the circumstances, which include the commitment of those commanders to general ideas about the rule of law. Not that that's encouraging in the current circumstances, but the sort of analytic point is that martial law in itself is not necessarily incompatible with practices that are consistent with rule of law ideas, although almost inevitably, some of those rule of law ideas will be sacrificed under martial law. Okay. The law about a presidential emergency powers to use the military for domestic law enforcement is complicated and unclear. There certainly are historical examples where presidents have claimed this power. President Washington led 13,000 militiamen to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion. President Cleveland called out the army to stop the Pullman strike in the 1890s. President Hoover ordered the U.S. Army, led by General Douglas MacArthur, to clear out the so-called bonus marchers during the Depression. President Eisenhower federalized the National Guard over the governor's opposition to force a desegregation order in Little Rock. And Lyndon Johnson used the military both to enforce civil rights orders and to quell rioters.
I suppose we could go through the various statutes and constitutional arguments that relate to the issue. I don't know how productive that would be. I've emphasized before that the law loses much of its importance. It surrenders to non-law when we're in the middle of a revolution, and that's where we are now. For me, the more interesting issues are tactical or prudential, and that gets us back to the prudential component of the moral arguments about civil disobedience. Does it help or hurt the cause of anti-Trump forces to confront the military? That's an important question. I think the answer is bound to depend on the circumstances and on how the confrontation is conducted and plays out. But it's also a question on which I don't claim any special expertise.
Nor do I. So let's move on to our final current event, the Trump administration's attack on Harvard Well, I sort of want to say on the University of Virginia, but that the legal issues in connection with Virginia are a little different. I just want to note about University of Virginia. I think we both know Jim Ryan. I don't know if you do, but...
I do. There's not a more decent human being on the face of the earth.
He really is a good guy. The one note about him, there are maybe three or four notes written by law students as law students that have enduring value as scholarship.
I'm sure you're going to include mine as one of them, right?
Right. And Jim wrote one of them, a very important analysis of the Supreme Court's decisions to the time he was writing in cases involving regulation of religious activities. Okay, so back to that, back to the Harvard. I'm going to drag some theory in at the end, but basically what we need to do is to lay out some of the constitutional issues, and we'll focus on the attempt to prevent Harvard from enrolling students from outside the United States by denying the students' visas. In the view of people who know about these things, almost everything the administration has done seems likely to violate the Administrative Procedure Act, but we're not going to get into that. I'd make the observation, though, that their failures to comply, apparent failures to comply with the APA, show that they really aren't interested in doing things that comply with the law anyway. So almost everything I've read says that the administration's actions obviously violate Harvard's rights under the First Amendment or some subset of those rights described as academic freedom. Frankly, I'm not so sure. The reason is that the actions implicate what's known as the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, which almost no one understands. I've said in public that you, Mike, are the only person I know who might understand the doctrine go back to the old joke about religious people. I'm not so sure about you. I certainly don't understand the doctrine. And so here's the setup. If you want or have and want to continue to have a student visa, you have to enroll in an institution that satisfies a bunch of requirements and have to take a prescribed number of credits or the equivalent. And that general rule is sensible. Congress can reasonably say that it's a bad idea to attract the students to the United States if they're going to be ripped off by institutions that call themselves educational but are simply scam operations.
Trump University, for example.
Right. So the question is, what sorts of requirements do the government impose for institutions to be eligible to enroll people with student visas? There are lots of things that are pretty clearly okay. To be eligible, you can't discriminate on the basis of race, for example. Or to be eligible, you have to require that students whose first language isn't English show that they understand English well enough to benefit from your educational programs. And pretty clearly, to be eligible, you have to provide us with information about students so that we can check that they actually are taking a minimum number of credits each semester. That is, that they actually are students, unlike, for example, Elon Musk, who apparently got a student visa and then never, I'm overstating this, but never went to class. So what limits are there on the conditions the government can require? Can it say affirmatively we're going to give student visas only to students who are going to enroll in STEM courses? Can the government say to be eligible, that is, will allow students to enroll in your school only if you don't teach critical race theory? To be eligible, you have to discipline, even expel students who say things that contribute to creating a campus environment hostile to Jewish students, even if those things set outside the campus context would be protected by the First Amendment. Okay, so now take it away.
Well, I guess I better start by disputing the claim that I'm the only person who understands the unconstitutional condition doctrine, both because I don't understand it and because I think there are some other people who understand it better than I do. Years ago, I was interviewing for a job at Shea and Gardner, and Frank Shea, a named partner, told me that he was one of only three people on the face of the earth who understood the Railway Labor Act, and then he went on to say, two of them are dead, and then he went on to say, and I'm not dead. So I can't say that I'm the only person, or even I am a person who understands the unconstitutional condition doctrine, but I am going to try my best to say something about it. But before I do, though, I just want to add a word about the way in which the dispute with Harvard relates to the Trump phenomenon more generally and to our discussions about constitutional theories. So the attack on Harvard is a quintessential attack on elites and on the supposed expertise of elites. That's true, and to a large measure, the defense of Harvard is a defense by elites of elites. And obviously, my sympathies are with Harvard, but I also do think that there is something to be said about the position of Trump and his supporters. So Harvard, despite some kind of half-hearted efforts to democratize, is still an institution that offers entry tickets into wealth and privilege in the country. And I think Harvard could do some important things to blunt the Trump attack by democratizing itself. So one sort of kind of crazy idea I have is I think it would just be a great thing if Harvard announced that it was creating a new department in educating people in skills they need for blue-collar jobs. So instead of majoring in philosophy or physics, one could major in becoming an electrician or a construction worker. The advantage of this is that these people would get the same excellent liberal education that Harvard students now get, but then in addition to that, they would learn something that is valuable not just to people in elite fields, but to what more average Americans do. So, but let's put that all that to one side and talk about constitutional doctrine here. And I agree, Mark, it's not a slam dunk for Harvard. So to make a very complicated story way too simple, there are two interrelated doctrinal distinctions, both of which are at least manipulatable and maybe just plain old incoherent. So the first distinction is between government speech and private speech. When private individuals speak, the government is sharply constricted in what it can do to obstruct the speech. If the government uses the allocation of benefits to suppress speech, that at least raises constitutional issues and, depending on the circumstances, may just be flatly unconstitutional. On the other hand, the government has the right to say or not to say anything that it wants. So the government speech is not limited by the First Amendment. There's no problem with the government, constitutional problem with the government saying some things and not saying other things. And sometimes the court characterizes government allocation of benefits as actually a form of government speech. So, for example, the court has held that when the government puts a monument donated by a private group in a public park, even though the monument was not created by the government, the placement of it in the park constitutes government speech. And that means that the government does not violate free speech protections when it declines to put other monuments expressing other points of view in the park. So the first issue here is whether what's going on here is government impingement on private speech or government speech. So, for example, Trump might claim that the student visa program is a way for the government to advance religious tolerance, and therefore that students likely to express anti-Semitic views don't qualify for the program. A second closely related issue relates to the scope of a program that the government funds or refuses to fund. So, in general, the government is under no constitutional obligation to fund speech that it doesn't like. For example, if the government has a program that provides money for patriotic speech, it doesn't have to provide money for non-PA or anti-patriotic speech. But here's what the government can't do. It can't leverage its funding of some speech to prevent other speech. Suppose, for example, some of a group's speech is patriotic and some of it is not patriotic. What the government can't say is that we aren't going to fund the patriotic speech because you're using separate money to pay for non-patriotic speech. Of course, the application of that principle depends on how broadly we characterize the program that the government is funding, and that adds more indeterminacy to the mix. So how do these principles intersect with the facts of the Harvard case? Really, it's anyone's guess. And as usual, I think the outcome is likely to be determined by whether the judge adjudicating the case is sympathetic or unsympathetic to Harvard.
Okay, great. So there's a cartoon that I regularly refer to in my classes in which a teacher asks a student, "Now do you understand?" And the student replies, "No, but now I'm confused on a much higher level." It turns out that that phrase comes from an educational psychologist and was popularized by, among other people, the great physicist Enrico Fermi. I said I'd wrap this up with some comments about what we've been talking about and constitutional theory. I do want to make a note about your suggestion about a program Harvard could adopt. You know, I don't have any expertise in this, but from a social point of view, I think you'd have to ask what's the social cost of doing what you suggest by, for example, diverting funds from mRNA research. I have no idea what the answer to that is, but
it's always a comparative judgment and a compared to what judgments.
Right,
that's right. But if the funds were diverted from, say, the study of Kantian philosophy to training people to be to do the labor they actually do, I think I know which way I come out, even as somebody who personally is fascinated by Kantian philosophy.
Okay, well, I don't know what the answer is. So here's the constitutional theory point. It's a common observation that the institutions of liberal governance, or if you prefer, the institutions of self-governance, can't sustain themselves on their own. A great German constitutional theorist, Ernst Wolfgang Bockenford, put it this way: the liberal secularized state lives by prerequisites which it cannot guarantee itself. The word secularized points to his and other solutions. Liberal government can be sustained, that is, points to his solution was religion. You don't have to take that position. Bockenford was an interesting guy. He was a Christian Democrat, leftist, supporter of the German social welfare state, who was a devotee of the Nazi theorist Carl Schmitt. It's a weird combination. Okay, so liberal government can be sustained only if civil society's institutions are vibrant. Civil society institutions include churches, as Bockenford's quotation indicates, but also the press and universities. The press and universities publish reports and research findings that can counter government propaganda or lies. So an attack on civil society's institutions is an attack on liberal governance itself. It turns out, though, that in contemporary society, many civil society institutions require some degree of support from the government. Press conglomerates that run radio and TV stations have to get licenses, which makes their print operations vulnerable to pressures. Universities get support for research from the public fisc, and so on. Even churches aren't free from this difficulty, as we've seen, as some churches struggle to figure out how to reconcile their traditional commitments to assistance for migrants and refugees with government policies that require them to expose their buildings to intrusive inspections. Even more, the stuff that comes out of university research counters government propaganda only if people think that scientists and everyone else who produces research results, your elites, have better access to the truth, have what's been called better epistemic authority than does the government. And for complicated reasons, some good, some bad, the epistemic authority of civil society's institutions has been eroding over the past century. So it's no longer quite true that, as the saying goes, you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not your own facts. We're in a world of Kellyanne Conway's alternate facts. And to bring the point down to the president, the Secretary of the Treasury dismissed the Congressional Budget Office estimate of the increase in the federal deficit that Trump's one big beautiful bill would produce as DC math. So civil society can't today solve Bakkenford's paradox if it ever could. I guess the bottom line is once again that there aren't any guarantees that liberal democracy can sustain itself. People have to commit themselves to that project and work diligently at it, and even then things might go pear-shaped.
And on that somewhat dismal, if accurate, warning, I think we're at the end of this episode. Our thanks once again to Sophia Poulos, Kennard King, Jenna Lindgad, and Therese Edwards for superb technical assistance, and to Randy Pfeiffer for composing and playing the wonderful music that you're listening to now.
See you next time.